I saw when the Lamb opened one of the seals, and I heard, as it were, the noise of thunder, saying, "Come and see."
Noise of Thunder Radio with Christian J. Pinto.
Okay, praise the Lord, you guys, and welcome. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Today on the show, we are going to talk about, well, we're going to give kind of an update on the Islamophobia situation, because there's a couple of things happening where Islamophobia is concerned. Now, Islamophobia is, this is something that we have to keep an eye on, I believe, in our country. And really, anybody, if you're in a Western country anywhere, keep an eye on all the arguments surrounding so-called Islamophobia. Because there's no question, as I've said before, and as others are reporting and documenting and warning about all over the internet, the Islamophobia argument is being used to usher in Sharia law in Western countries. And the way that it works is, they claim that Islamophobia is this problem that goes on, that Muslims are in danger. Their lives are in danger because of Islamophobia, the irrational fear of Islam. The bigots and the racists in the Western world are guilty of all sorts of hate crimes, supposedly, against Muslims. So therefore, laws must be passed to protect the Muslims from these terrible hate crimes that are allegedly taking place. And so what that means is that special laws need to be created that will protect Islam. And anyone who speaks against Islam, uses any kind of hostile or hateful rhetoric against Islam or against Muslims, etc., must now be punished by law. This is something they've tried to do in the United States. It didn't go anywhere. I don't foresee that going anywhere. I don't foresee the Democrats being able, they've tried to push that here in our country through the House of Representatives. It didn't get off the ground, obviously, but they tried to do it. The fact that they tried to do it, that alone should be cause for concern for all Americans, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, whatever you are, you ought to be very, very concerned about that. Because if they usher in Sharia law in our country, it basically strips the rights of all non-Muslims. Muslims, ultimately, are the only ones who have any rights under Sharia. Everybody else becomes a sub-citizen. You're just really living at the whim or at the grace of Islam. And if the Muslims want to victimize you, they can, under Sharia. Now, obviously, they're not going to usher in, I'm not suggesting that they're going to usher in Sharia law in such a blatant, forward way. They have to use very clever and deceptive methods to carry this thing out, as they do with everything else in this leftist agenda. All right, now in Canada, we've talked about this situation in Canada with the whole Islamophobia motion. They call it M103. It's not exactly a law based on what they're saying. It's more a motion that the government will look into matters having to do with hate speech and Islamophobia, that they'll pay attention to this, etc. It doesn't necessarily create a law. At least that's what they're saying. However, as we talked about on the program before, we have seen liberals do this kind of thing, where a motion like this could later be interpreted as a law, although that's in Canada. We'll have to wait and see what happens. However, in conjunction with this, Jihad Watch is reporting that in Canada, Ontario unanimously passes anti-Islamophobia motion. Unanimously passes an anti-Islamophobia motion. And if you read the rest of that article, it seems like that motion is separate from M103, which is happening at the federal level. Okay? In Parliament. So, but this is what Spencer calls a worrying trend in Canada. He talks about M103 and then how six Canadian cities signed a charter against Islamophobia this past summer, drafted by the National Council of Canadian Muslims. And then it goes on from there. So there is this anti-Islamophobia movement going on in Canada where they're gaining lots of support for this concept of taking a stand against Islamophobia. Now, they'll say they want to take a stand against all forms of hate speech, etc., and bigotry and that kind of thing. And then they'll say Islamophobia. They won't say hate speech against Christians or anti-Semitism against Jews. You see what I'm saying? They don't do that. They don't do that. Which if they did, they would then back the Muslims into a wall. They would back the Muslims there and say, okay, we're going to stand against Islamophobia, but we're also not going to tolerate anyone denouncing Christianity with hateful rhetoric or denouncing Jewish people with hateful rhetoric. They could do that, but they don't. They don't. The only thing that's specifically pointed out is Islam. And so they give the impression, if you read these articles and so on, the people who are defending the anti-Islamophobia motion, they'll say things to the effect that, well, we're against all forms of hatred and make it appear as though this applies to everyone. But the reality is the only belief system that they're directly highlighting and really exalting above all others is Islam. That's all they're doing. They're not calling for a special law to protect Christians against hatred or to protect Jews against anti-Semitism and this kind of thing. They're not doing that at all. They're only pointing out Islam. And this is what exalts Islam to that place of prominence and priority. And that's the foundation of Sharia. That's the foundation of Sharia. You punish people who speak against the Islamic belief system. Anybody who speaks against Islam, you punish them. Now, here in the United States, there's a story. A Muslim NSC staffer quits National Security Council. Her name is Rumana Ahmed, a hijab-wearing Muslim woman who worked at the NSC during the Obama administration, but now has quit now that Donald Trump is president. And her reason that she gave, she said, quote, "I had to leave because it was an insult walking into this country's most historic building every day under an administration that is working against and vilifying everything I stand for as an American and as a Muslim." Okay, that's what she said, that the Trump administration is working against everything she stands for. Now you have to wonder, what exactly is she standing for that Trump is against? The only thing Trump is against is trying to keep Islamic radicals. I mean, the only thing he's officially against, based on what he said, he hasn't banned Muslims from every Muslim country. He's only pointed out troublesome areas where there are high levels of reported terrorist activity and jihadi activity where you've got people who are very hostile toward the United States. And all he's done is ban a series of countries, but you've got more than 50 Muslim countries out there. Most of them are not banned. And so they're calling this a Muslim ban, and this is supposedly racism, etc., and all this other kind of stuff, all of this craziness that makes no sense whatsoever. So in the midst of all this, she decides to step down. Now, she's been talking about this and the direction of the country and Islamophobia and all this other kind of stuff, and claims that after 9/11, that after September the 11th, she was treated in a very hostile manner. She says, quote, after that she claims, she starts by claiming that she had been living the American dream. And then she says, quote, after 9/11, everything would change. On top of my shock, horror, and heartbreak, I had to deal with the fear some kids suddenly felt towards me. I was glared at, cursed at, and spat at in public and in school. People called me a terrorist and told me, go back to your country. Right? This is what she says. Now, when people read that kind of thing, of course, they think, oh, well, that's terrible. But remember something. As Jihad Watch points out in this article, it's very, very important that many of these claims by Muslims that they've been subjected to hate crimes, these are quite often fake claims. I mean, some of them very, very audacious claims that are made. And so the article says, quote, not surprisingly, Ahmed made no mention of the fact that this Muslim victimhood narrative has been sullied, if not vitiated entirely, by the high number of anti-Muslim hate crimes that turn out to have been faked by Muslims. The Hamas-linked Council on American Relations, CARE, and other Muslims have on many occasions not hesitated to stoop even to fabricating hate crimes, including attacks on mosques and even murders. He goes on and says, a New Jersey Muslim was found guilty of murder that he tried to portray as an Islamophobic attack. And in 2014 in California, a Muslim was found guilty of killing his wife after first blaming her murder on Islamophobia. This is what makes it very, very difficult to trust these kind of claims coming from any Muslims, because they have their doctrine of taqiyya, al-taqiyya, which permits them, it's basically the doctrine of lying, and so they're permitted to lie to the infidels and to tell the kafir or the kufar whatever it is that they need to advance the cause of Islam. And if that means lying about a hate crime or anything else, if that's going to advance the agenda, then that's perfectly acceptable. Perfectly acceptable. And I've talked about on the program before the website Wikislam. You can go online, type in fake anti-Muslim hate crimes or hate crimes that never were against Muslims, something like that. Fake hate crimes against Muslims, etc. And type that in and you'll find a whole list of them. In many of them here in the United States and in other parts of Europe and other parts of the world and so on, Islam has been doing this for decades. In fact, I remember doing some research and I stumbled across a very disturbing photograph. It is called the 1963 Bathtub Murders. The 1963 Bathtub Murders. That's how you would look it up. Anyway, it shows a photograph of a mother and her children lying in a bathtub and they were killed. What happened was this photograph was circulated on the island of Cyprus to ultimately stir up the Turkish Muslims against the Greek Christians. And then the Turkish government came in, intervened, divided the island, pushed the Greek Christians off half of it, and took control of the other half. And that situation there has been very controversial even to this day. Anyway, if you look up this photograph, however, there's a website that talks about this, and here's what it says. The official Turkish Cypriot version of events was called into question by Kostas Yanaris when he revealed in his book that the Turkish photojournalist claimed to have taken the photograph of the bathtub murder victims under orders and in suspicious circumstances. Curious about what had really happened in that bathroom, he had investigated and discovered that, quote, the children's father had gone berserk, killing his children and his wife in cold blood. The killer disappeared, spirited away by the Turkish authorities. Okay? So apparently this was a case where you had a Muslim who killed his own wife and his own children, put their bodies in a bathtub. Then the Turkish authorities bring in a photographer. They take a picture of it and turn and blame it on the Greek Christians all as part of a subversive agenda to get control of at least part of the island of Cyprus. All right, let's go to our commercial break, and we will talk more when we come back right after this.
Adullam Films presents an exciting new documentary, Bridge to Babylon, part three in an award-winning series on the untold history of the Bible. Dr. Jack Moorman calls it a masterful presentation of what is the single most important issue facing Christians today, the defense of the Bible as the Word of God. Why was the Bible changed in 1881? Why have so many churches abandoned biblical inerrancy? And what direction are scholars taking the scriptures today? Learn the truth in Bridge to Babylon, the sequel to A Lamp in the Dark and Tares Among the Wheat. Bridge to Babylon is now available at noiseofthunderradio.com. That's noiseofthunderradio.com.
Hello, I'm Brandon House. In April of 2013, I found a Mountain House distributor and ordered some freeze-dried food for my family because I had become concerned about what was happening in America. Our lack of national security, the threat to our power grid. I've been a customer of Mountain House through one of their distributors. But now, Worldview Weekend, as of October 25th, 2016, has been approved to be a distributor for Mountain House. Now look, the key word here is balance. We don't put our hope in horses and chariots. We don't put our security in food and gold and silver. But it is important to be diversified and to be prepared. And if you're interested, you can now go into the bookstore at worldviewweekend.com/bookstore and check out some of the freeze-dried food that you can order. I think people ought to have a little bit put aside, as I've done since April of 2013, in case of an emergency. You get free shipping and handling, and you're supporting the general operating budget of Worldview Weekend. Just simply visit our bookstore, worldviewweekend.com/bookstore, worldviewweekend.com/bookstore.
Okay, we are back. Praise the Lord, you guys. I'm Chris Pinto. This is Noise of Thunder Radio. Thanks for staying with the show today. I did want to point out on the Turkish propaganda, the what's called the 1963 bathtub murders. The website that I'm basing that information on is called seka.org.au. And it says the Justice for Cyprus Coordinating Committee, Victoria. Okay? That is the name of the website. And so that's what they call themselves. Justice for Cyprus Coordinating Committee. Says it was created after the 1974 invasion of Cyprus by Turkey, and its purpose was and continues to be to work for a fair and just settlement to the Cyprus issue. So, as I said, this conflict in Cyprus over the Turks coming in and basically seizing control of about half the island continues to this day. In fact, I was reminded of it here in the last couple of weeks. I was watching a news reporter, a documentary or something online, and they were interviewing a British man whose family had come from Cyprus, and he remembered going there as a little boy, words to this effect, I'm paraphrasing him, but he basically said he saw what happened in Cyprus, how it is now an island, used to be a Greek Christian island, now divided by the Muslims, the Turks, because they emigrated. All these Turks were coming in there, these Muslims, and once they built up their population to a certain point, that's when the government of Turkey came in with their military and seized control of a significant portion of the island, and they drove out Christians, Greek Christians, from many of their homes and so on, many different areas. They forced them out because they said, we're going to take over these areas, and then they created a border within Cyprus itself and said, okay, this area will now be under Turkish control. And his suggestion seemed to be that the same thing could happen in the United Kingdom or something like it. That was his implication. So I thought it was very interesting. But he says it all begins with immigration, with having them build up their population in a country. That's the first step. And so, of course, he was expressing his concern about the buildup of Muslims there in the UK. All right, let's go on. I want to cover a couple of different issues here. Let's talk about Rome and Islam. Another update on Rome and Islam. There's two very, very interesting stories. One on Jihad Watch. Another one from the website, the Church Militant, the Catholic website. First on Jihad Watch, you have a story here about a Catholic priest. It says, the headline says, Catholic scholar of Islam, the average Muslim sees Islam as a religion of peace, quote unquote. They're quoting this Catholic scholar, who is a Catholic priest. And his name is Father Thomas Michel, M-I-C-H-E-L. I think I'm pronouncing that right. But anyway, you read this article, and what this priest is doing is quoting from Vatican Council II. This is what I've been telling you for a while, brethren. Vatican Council II in the early 1960s is what opened the door philosophically to Islam and welcomed them into the West, into the Western world. And remember, it was the Jesuits who crafted this dialogue and rhetoric in Vatican Council II. This was their brainchild. You go study Vatican II, their Jesuit writers are all over this thing. I mean, there were other writers as well, but the Jesuits were the driving force. There's no question about that. So here's what this article says. It says, not only is there a good deal in common between Muslims and Christians, but Catholics are called to respect and work together with those who practice the Muslim faith in recognition of truth and goodness they do possess, said Islam scholar Father Thomas Michel. Father Michel, who holds a PhD in Islamic theology and worked under Pope John Paul II as head of the Vatican Office for Relations with Muslims. Remember, Pope John Paul II famously kissed the Quran, okay, a book that openly denies that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. So this priest worked under Pope John Paul II, also under Pope Benedict. Now, I want to skip down a little bit in this article and get to this point where they quote Father Michel. It says, quote, Father Michel noted that when the fathers of the council taught us, meaning Vatican Council II, says, when the fathers of the council taught us, they didn't deny the past conflict and tension between Catholics and Muslims, but they did say that it is in the past. Now, this is, I specifically pointed this out on an earlier program, brethren, and I actually read the passages from Vatican Council II where they openly say this. And this is what Robert Spencer is talking about in this article here, because he goes on to say, he says, it says that they said these conflicts, they did say that it is in the past. And Spencer's comment, he says, quote, they were wrong. It isn't in the past, as even the most cursory knowledge of the decimation of the ancient Christian communities of Iraq and Syria should show. Okay? And he's exactly right there. This is exactly the point that I tried to make before, that it's, you know, what the Jesuits did in the 1960s, they basically said, well, we're just going to let bygones be bygones and forget all the conflicts in the past. The problem with that is that the Islamic world didn't sit down and agree to any of this. The Islamic world was invading Christian countries all the way prior to Vatican Council II. Things like the Armenian genocide and the invasion of Smyrna all happened in the decades prior to Vatican II. So you have Muslims that were still mass murdering Christians well into the 20th century. This wasn't ancient history. This wasn't something from 500 years earlier or something like that. Not at all. And that's why I say this would be like having, you know, Ted Bundy and Charles Manson and John Wayne Gacy and so on, these guys, serial murderers sitting in prison, and they're unrepentant, and they're sitting there saying, well, we had a right to commit all these horrible crimes and whatever. And then somebody walks in and says, well, let's just forget about the past. We're all going to be friends now, and let's let these guys out of prison and welcome them back into society. And we're just going to embrace them. Nobody in their right mind would do that. Nobody in their right mind would do that. And yet this is exactly what Vatican Council II proposed to do with the Islamic world. We're going to forget about the past, even though Islam hasn't forgotten it. Islam has never repented of its atrocities and crimes against the Christian world or the Jewish world or anyone else. They still believe their actions were justifiable, because it was all in keeping with the teachings of Muhammad. All right, now I want to move on to this article from thechurchmilitant.com, a very interesting headline. Church Militant is reporting, quote, Democrat Party headed by two faithless Catholics. Democrat Party headed by two faithless Catholics. And here's what they say, quote, Tom Perez, a Catholic, and Keith Ellison, a fallen away Catholic, are the new heads of the Democratic Party. Then it goes on from there. Now, this article is very interesting, brethren. I was not aware. I've never really paid much attention to Tom Perez until now. But Tom Perez was Jesuit educated. He was educated by the Jesuits at Canisius High School, a Jesuit school in Buffalo, New York, and still maintains, Perez does, that he is a Catholic to this day. The article goes on to talk about that. Ellison, Keith Ellison, it says, later on, it says, Keith Ellison, although not practicing, was brought up Catholic in the Archdiocese of Detroit, Michigan, having attended the University of Detroit Jesuit High School and Academy. So both of the heads of the Democratic Party today are both Jesuit educated. Fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. All right, brethren, we are out of time for our program today. That's going to do it. That's our show. We'll stop it there. But we will be back next time as the Lord leads us. Until then, God bless you guys. I'm Chris Pinto, and you've been listening to Noise of Thunder Radio.